Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Dr. Ahmad Youssef, a pediatrician from Arkansas, who recounts his experience volunteering to provide life-saving health care to Palestinian civilians in Gaza under relentless and vicious Israeli attack. James Risen, a best-selling author and former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, who explains why he believes that Donald Trump's racism is the most important driver of his voter support. And Joshua Rovner of the Sentencing Project, who talks about his group's new report that finds a decline in U.S. juvenile incarceration, but persistent racial disparities in youth arrests, convictions, and sentencing. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On August 5th, Wall Street suffered its worst day in almost 2 years after a global stock market sell-off sparked by fears of a U.S. recession. The market's plunge began in Asia, where Japan's Nikkei stock index fell 12.4% in its worst day since the Black Monday crash of 1987. European markets followed suit, with Britain's FTSE suffering its steepest one-day decline in more than a year. But the panic didn't last long, and markets quickly recovered. The steep one-day drop was caused in part by the Bank of Japan's July 31st decision to raise its key interest rate, causing the value of the yen to rise, and alarm over an unexpectedly weak U.S. jobs report. The market sell-off was also a response to the U.S. Federal Reserve, which had announced it would keep high interest rates in place, prompting critics to accuse the central bank of waiting too long to cut rates. The Federal Reserve began increasing interest rates more than 2 years ago in an effort to curb inflation. The move was designed to slow the economy by making borrowing expensive for companies and households. But after Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's long-anticipated August 23rd announcement that the time has come to begin cutting interest rates, which is expected to be formally posted in September, all three major U.S. stock indexes rallied. This would be the Federal Reserve's first such interest rate cut in over 4 years. For weeks, radical right-wing groups have targeted their vicious attacks on Vice President Kamala Harris, now the Democratic Party's official nominee, who will face off against Donald Trump in the U.S. election. But in the shadowy world of violent extremists, The Guardian newspaper reports longtime neo-Nazi group The Base is seeking to recruit new members in the U.S. to carry out an unknown campaign in the weeks prior to the November election. The group was founded by former Pentagon contractor Ronaldo Nazaro, now based in Russia, who is offering to pay a U.S. leader $1,200 a month to recruit and train a 6-to-12-man team. Nazaro is currently wanted by the FBI and is suspected to be working as a Russian intelligence asset. European officials are increasingly worried about the base and its operations in Europe, especially in light of recent anti-immigrant riots in Britain blamed on violent far-right white supremacist groups. The base, considered a domestic terrorism threat in the lead-up to the 2020 U.S. presidential election, adheres to the principles of accelerationism, a hyper-violent political doctrine calling on followers to hasten the collapse of society through acts of terrorism. For the first time in memory, Arizona's largest public school district in Greater Phoenix is refusing to open their gyms and cafeterias to be used as polling stations. Maricopa County's refusal is a response to multiple threats and intimidation targeting students and school personnel that occurred in 2023 and in advance of this November's presidential election. For generations, public schools have opened their doors to be locations for polling stations. But the threat of chaos and violence by the state's right-wing activists is forcing election officials to rent storefronts or vacant spaces in malls for polling places. The Washington Post reports that since Donald Trump first became a presidential candidate in 2016, the percentage of school facilities used as polling locations in Maricopa County has fallen from 37% to 14%. Trump's narrow 2020 loss in the swing state inspired bizarre conspiracy theories and death threats against county leaders who oversee voting and election workers. Scott Menzel, superintendent of the Scottsdale School District, says that in this environment, where you have people with body cameras and weapons coming to polling places, it just takes one flashpoint to ignite something that's catastrophic. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
During the Democratic Party convention in Chicago last week, a message of unity and hope was projected by Vice President Kamala Harris and her vice presidential running mate, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. But while there was a feeling of optimism among thousands of convention delegates about the party's prospects in this November's election, Palestinian Americans were feeling anger and frustration that their request for a speaker to address the convention about the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza was rejected by party officials. The group that requested a speaker, the Uncommitted National Movement, received more than 500,000 anti-war votes in Democratic Party primary elections across several states. Over the past 10 months, since the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel that killed 1,200 and kidnapped 240 hostages, more than 40,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, have been killed by Israeli airstrikes and ground assaults using bombs and missiles supplied by the U.S. Six American doctors, who had recently volunteered to provide life-saving health care to Gaza residents, traveled to the Chicago convention to directly appeal to Democratic Party officials to allow one of them to speak to the nation about the humanitarian catastrophe they witnessed in Gaza. Your reporter spoke with one of those physicians, Dr. Ahmed Youssef, a pediatrician from Arkansas, who recounts his harrowing 3-week experience earlier this summer when he volunteered in Gaza to provide critical health care in Al-Aqsa's hospital's intensive care unit and emergency room.
When I entered Gaza, I knew things were going to be bad, but immediately the thing that hit me hard and every doctor and every humanitarian worker that was with me was that what we were seeing was truly unfathomable in terms of the extent of the destruction. You know, I can't truly articulate feeling like I was in a post-apocalyptic zombie movie in terms of how much destruction. Every building in Rafah, which is the southernmost part of Gaza, all the way through Khan Yunis, which is just north of that, into the middle area where I was. Every building up until Deir Bala, that middle area, was on the ground, destroyed in some capacity, uninhabitable, people living in the street, under rubble, trying their best to survive, all water infrastructure destroyed, every hospital I saw destroyed, every police station I saw destroyed, every mosque and church on the ground. The level of devastation made me realize two things really quickly. One was that I was never truly going to be able to convey to the justice of what I was seeing, because there are no words and even videos that could truly do justice to what we saw. And the only way that was ever going to be truly visible to the world was whenever this ceasefire is had, and international journalists like yourself, who are third party. I'm not a journalist. None of the doctors want to be journalists. We aren't good at that. I'm not particularly good at this part. And unfortunately, we were all forced to because of the reality of how severe the level of brutality and carnage was. There is no CNN, no NBC, no BBC on the ground because they've been restricted. And to me, that is telling. It was all by design. There's very few international eyes, and that's because if people saw what I saw, their hearts were turned the way mine did. The pit in their stomach would get deeper, and we would all be in a very different state of affairs in terms of our understanding of our obligation as a country and as humanity and how to address what's going on there. Beyond the bombs that are dropping 24/7 while we were there, we can hear bombs like rolling thunder and the drones above our head that sound like a lawnmower. Beyond all this, for 10 months, there's been no access to medical supplies or consistent sources of acceptable levels of nutrition or safe water. And so what we saw was not just in the patients, but in my fellow healthcare workers, the gods and to me, the true gods and heroes, the physicians and the nursing staff, that every single person I met was malnourished to some level. Every doctor, they would joke around about how they were swimming in their own clothes because they had lost 30 and 40 kilograms, right? That's 60, 70, 80 pounds of weight over 10 months because they haven't had consistent. They would be eating white rice if they were able to get it from humanitarian aid packages previously. And before this current escalation on October 7th and beyond, before that, the Gazan people, since 2005, put on what many people locally and in Israel call the Gazan diet, right? They had a caloric restriction per citizen of Gaza before October. This is before the 7th attack by Hamas, okay? And so this is just an exacerbation on a chronic problem, and that's what this felt like. Every possible sociological and kind of infrastructure disease, if you want to use that word, that's the word I would use, that was allowed to fester pre this attack, pre-October 7th. Is now in full exacerbation. People do not have medication. We saw people at the end stages of their disease processes, like kidney disease and diabetes. We saw people, because of the level of malnourishment, they were dying of simple illnesses, including diarrheal illnesses that they were getting because the water was completely contaminated and there was no source of clean water consistently. And finally, right, the most recent kind of horror in all of this is we were seeing diseases that have been obliterated in the world by the public health system internationally, like polio, that could only exist in two environments. One where we've completely destroyed an infrastructure of healthcare delivery that was considered standard in even the poorest and most underserved places on earth, things like vaccines that are free because of the organizations that exist in the world, and in combination with a level of malnourishment and malnutrition that allows for very simple childhood diseases to progress to end-stage disease. And so it doesn't shock me that we see polio. It doesn't shock me that we saw kids and infants dying of simple pediatric illnesses because they were in a state of affairs where they didn't have access to the simple things that keep us alive, like clean water and nutrition.
Dr. Youssef, you were part of a group of six doctors who had volunteered in Gaza that came to the Chicago Convention to hold a press conference. What was your message then to the Democratic Party and the nation about the role of the Biden administration and our military in supporting Israel's brutal war in Gaza? And what was your reaction when the organizers of the Democratic Convention denied your request?
You know, the people on the side of the aisle that must be for humanitarian aid to vulnerable people, you would think it would be the Democrats. But unfortunately, the administration that currently sits in office has put us in a situation where we're choosing between somebody who articulates the desire to support genocide in the Republican candidate and somebody who for the last 10 months has supported genocide for the last 10 months with financial and verbal and in every way support that you could possibly imagine. And so I was left unsurprised because you can only judge people for what they do and not for what they say. And for the last 10 months, we've had an example of what Joe Biden and his platform has represented. And unfortunately, it appears, based upon the response of the vice president's party ticket and platform at the DNC, is that we're just moving into an environment where for the next 4 years, we'll either be dealing with this on the MAGA side or on the Democratic side. And that's an unfortunate reality and something that anybody who's anti-genocide, unfortunately, has come to get used to at this point in our country.
That was Dr. Ahmed Youssef, a pediatrician from Arkansas, who volunteered to provide critical health care to Palestinian victims of Israel's war in Gaza. Learn more about the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Although Donald Trump's unexpected 2016 Electoral College victory over Hillary Clinton was explained by some pundits as a symptom of many American voters' economic anxiety, others identified the former TV reality star's openly racist rhetoric and blatant demonization of immigrants, people of color, and religious minorities as his main appeal. While not forcefully examined in most U.S. corporate media, Trump has a long record of racist statements and actions During his time as a New York City real estate developer, Republican Party candidate, and one-term president. In the 1970s, the Justice Department sued Trump for racial discrimination in the apartments he rented. In the 1980s, he purchased full-page newspaper advertisements calling for the death penalty for the black and Latino men wrongfully convicted of rape in the Central Park Five case. Before his run for president, Trump falsely and repeatedly declared that Barack Obama wasn't born in the U.S. and wasn't legally permitted to serve as president. During his time in the Oval Office, Trump openly expressed empathy with white supremacists. After neo-Nazis and other right-wing extremists marched in Charlottesville, Virginia, resulting in the murder of civil rights activist Heather Heyer, Trump responded to the violence by saying there were very fine people on both sides. Your reporter spoke with James Risen, a best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter, who explains why he believes that Donald Trump's racism is the most important driver of his voter support, which is examined in his recent Intercept article titled, Racism is Why Trump is So Popular.
You know, I think the truth is inescapable that Trump is a racist who has become popular because of his racism. I think that's a completely obvious statement, and yet the press is afraid to say it. And that's what really motivated me was, you know, my profession has been afraid of the truth.
Well, James, you begin your article by talking about what many people interpret as the reason that so many voters have cast their ballots for Trump in 2016 and 2020 and will again in 2024. And that reason we've heard is economic anxiety. Tell us about how you interpret the reason we hear constantly from our media that economic anxiety is the reason why so many people overlook all of Trump's well-documented flaws to vote for a guy because of economic anxiety.
Yeah, I've been deeply frustrated by that, too, because for many years I was a reporter in Detroit, and I was there during the worst of the economic downturns for the auto industry and the steel industry. And if ever there was a time when purely economic anxiety was going to lead to right-wing demagoguery and authoritarianism, it would have been the 1980s, not today. The economic situation in the Midwest is much better than it was back then. And so it never rang true to me that that was why this was happening. And having been a reporter for many years, I know what it's like to talk to people and to interview them. And in the space of a half an hour interview at a diner, no one is ever going to tell you the truth about why they voted for somebody. They're not going to admit, yes, I'm a racist. And it was a very shallow form of reporting. And reporters were able to go in with a preconceived narrative. I'm here in Michigan because people are upset about the economy. It's easy to get people to talk about something like that rather than saying to a reporter, I love him because he hates black people. That's just not going to happen. And so in a lot of ways, it was my own frustration with my own profession, which led me to write this and to think about it, because it was so obvious to me, having spent a lot of time there, what was really going on.
Well, James, in your article, you kind of suss out something that I remember as a quote from President Lyndon Baines Johnson, who once said, if you can convince the lowest white man he's better than the best colored man, he won't notice you're picking his pocket. Hell, if you give him somebody to look down on, and he'll empty his pockets for you. I think that gets to the heart of it. You want to speak on that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's been going on for generations with the Republican Party, and Trump has been doing it on steroids. The Republican Party has been built really on the idea that white working class voters are afraid of their social status in a society that's becoming more and more diverse. And if you act like they are the victims of some giant conspiracy, then that will make them feel better and they will not care that all of your economic policies are benefiting billionaires. And that's been the strategy really for a long time, but Trump has taken it to new levels. And he's been much more open and explicit about how he is there for the white man, who is a victim of diversity, a victim of a woke society. And it's all very transparent. And yet the press doesn't want to say that.
That was James Risen, Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter, now The Intercept's senior national security correspondent. Find a link to his recent article titled "Racism is Why Trump is So Popular" and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A new report from the Sentencing Project details how youth incarceration in the U.S. has declined an astonishing 75% between the years 2000 and 2022. However, racial and ethnic disparities in youth arrests, convictions, and sentencing persist. The Sentencing Project's new report, titled "Youth Justice by the Numbers," finds that a steep rise in incarceration rates occurred up to the year 2000, followed by a steep decline. When juveniles, those under 18 in almost all states, are accused of very serious crimes and are moved to the adult system, most youths, if they're incarcerated at all, are held in juvenile facilities. The report finds that youth of color are much more likely than white youth to be held in juvenile detention. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joshua Rovner, director of youth justice with the Sentencing Project and author of the report. Here he explains why the year 2000 was the peak of juvenile incarceration, with over 108,000 young people jailed, and some of the reasons behind racial disparities in youth imprisonment.
I do think that we saw increases in youth offending on serious and less serious charges, but also changes in policies that encourage the arrests of young people. So there's nothing more discretionary than arresting a young person for a curfew or loitering violation. Like, what's more typical than for a teenager than staying out late? And you see that same pattern for youth arrests for curfew and loitering violations that you see for overall arrests, which I think points to the discretion that is a big part of the system. Now, when it comes to the more violent offenses, we certainly have mercifully seen a drop in violent offending. But I think that there's any number of ways that our teenagers are doing better than they were when I was in high school. I graduated in 1993.
Josh Rovner, what could happen as a result of someone being arrested and moving through the juvenile justice system?
A child who is convicted in the juvenile system, the technical term is adjudicated delinquent, they can have a number of punishments along the way. They could certainly be let off with a warning. They could receive community service or request for restitution. They also can receive probation, or they could be locked up in youth prisons. That phrase is commitment. We see about 8% of cases that go to the courts ending in commitment. Now, every step along the way that I just talked about, the racial disparities grow. We see more leniency for white youth than for youth of color, which is why you get from a place where Black youth are 2.3 times as likely to be arrested, but are then 4.5 times as likely to be incarcerated in the juvenile system.
What are some of the options? Instead of arresting a young person, what could happen instead?
Well, there's any number of opportunities for what can be called pre-arrest diversion, meaning responding to the behaviors, even if they're technically violations of the law, by not arresting a kid. You do not need to call the police every time that kids get into trouble. And if police get there, that doesn't mean that they have to arrest someone. So you can easily imagine a pretty rough shoving match in a high school hallway. It certainly happened in my high school when I was there. And if it did, there was a social studies teacher who just, you know, grabbed the kid by the backpack and said, go to class. And if it was repeatedly a problem, then a vice principal or even a principal would get involved. But the idea that you would call police for that sort of ordinary adolescent misbehavior, that's not required. But there's the expression that when you're holding a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. And so for police officers hanging out in schools, which are generally pretty safe places, when they see things that are arrestable behaviors, because that behavior, that's a simple assault. Like, you're not allowed to put your hands on someone. You're not allowed to shove them. So do the police choose to make an arrest, or do they choose to de-escalate and say, what's going on here? Let's have a conversation. Let's get the school counselor involved before this escalates into something worse. So first, using some common sense and some discretion of whether this needs to be arrested at all, we see this when it comes to drug use for people of different backgrounds. It's very easy for some people's drug use to be seen as a medical problem, something to be treated, an addiction. And for others, it's seen as a criminal behavior. And I think that the more that we can see all of our kids as kids and treat them with compassion when they are addicted to drugs or using drugs and on a pathway to addiction, that is another alternative. There are good programs that do not require court involvement that you can refer people to. But I think the thing that I'm most hopeful for, when there is actual harm and an actual victim, are restorative justice programs. This involves the victim and the offender, a caring adult for both children involved, usually a parent, but doesn't have to be a parent, and a restorative justice coordinator who manages the conversation that takes place. Because usually these things don't come out of nowhere, right? Like, someone harms someone else because perhaps they were being bullied relentlessly. To break that cycle through a restorative justice conversation has shown much better results, not only in that it stops the offending to a much greater extent than court involvement does, but also gives the victim much better satisfaction of feeling like they've been heard and understood. Where the court processes, you know, for one thing, you have a lawyer speaking on your behalf, you're not speaking on your own, but also correctly, juvenile courts have confidentiality. So we don't know what comes of it when a young person gets referred to court. Did they get a serious response? Did they get probation? Did they get community service? No one knows, nor should they know, what happens in a juvenile court. Restorative Justice Circle does a much better job closing that loop, so that the victim knows that they have been heard, which I think is what most of us really want.
That was Joshua Rovner, Director of Youth Justice with the Sentencing Project. Learn more about juvenile justice reform and racial discrimination in youth incarceration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WEFR in Fairmont, West Virginia, KTAL in Las Cruces, New Mexico, KMXT in Kodiak, Alaska, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harrison.